I'm delighted to be here today with Benjamin Lyons and Marcus Shira, who are both economists. And I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves. And part of the reason that we're here talking is that Benjamin did a really interesting presentation on Michael Levin's Academic Channel about using price as the cognitive glue. Is that right? Okay. Michael Levin is always talking about bioelectric communication as the cognitive glue at the cellular level. And Benjamin was positing that perhaps it's the same thing as price in the world of Austrian economics. Is that, did I get that right?
Yes, although the analysis of price isn't specific to it's just mainstream at this point.
Okay. And so I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves and then we're going to start talking. I have a quote to start out with, and then I'm going to ask a couple of questions and see where we go from there. So, Marcus, why don't you start introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Marcus Shira. Right now, I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Smith Institute at Chapman University. But before that, I've spent the last 8 years doing my undergrad and graduate work at George Mason, which is a school known for its various eclectic approaches. Most of my dissertation work was on economic history and the economics of religion. But since I was at George Mason and with the Mercatus Center, we did a lot of work on Hayek and Kirzner and all these kinds of interesting things that are related to what Benjamin does. So I'm not familiar with the biological side of this, but I've ha hung out with a lot of people that are into the econ and self-organizing systems literature. So I'm excited to talk.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm Benjamin Lyons. I actually am not an economist in any professional sense. I have a bachelor's degree in economics from George Mason University,
Oh.
but I actually went into the private sector. I was a stockbroker with Fidelity Investments for several years, and then I quit my job to work on some research stuff full time. That's been going on for a few years now. That period of time is actually approaching its end, and I'll be going back to the private sector, hopefully sooner than later. And on that note, if you or Karen or anyone listening to this knows someone who is hiring, please send me an email because I am looking for a job.
I might know somebody to put you in touch with.
Please do. I need it.
Where do you live, Benjamin?
Denver, Colorado.
Okay. Very good. Okay, so I have a quote here that I saw on Twitter that I thought kind of framed the question in a very interesting way. Some person named Anna Riedel, she said, "Next time you have to explain why cognitive science shares theories and concepts with economics and finance, think about this. Both have a reliance on notions of efficiently allocating and utilizing limited resources that have alternative uses. Cognition optimizes a mental economy and has to determine the rational use of cognitive resources." And I thought this would also apply to a lot of Michael Levin's work, is that the cells have to optimize a kind of some sort of cognitive economy, some sort of communication economy through the bioelectrical signaling in order to determine the rational, I'm anthropomorphizing there, obviously, the appropriate use of the resources of the cells. There has to be some sort of a system going on there that is way more complicated than what we originally thought. So on that note, I'm going to ask you guys to drive down to just the base level of economics and talk about price, value, exchange. And what kinds of information do we get from what are each of those in terms of Austrian economics? And I'm using Austrian economics primarily because I think that's a kind of a meta system, actually, looking at the way the whole world operates. And I love the picture of Austrian economics. So what does it have to say about price? What does it have to say about value? And what does it have to say about exchange of resources, basically?
Well, Marcus, you're the one with the actual advanced degree. So why don't you give a summary of that, and then I'll see, maybe I have to talk a little bit about what that could mean in terms of biology.
Sure. So I guess the more primitive term is usually value. And sometimes people talk about value in two different senses. Adam Smith, all the way back, talks about this. Sometimes you use value in the more direct sense, like, oh, I value this cup of coffee, I like drinking it, right? Just that's something that I don't know where it comes from my background, comes from my biology, something like that. But then we also have the sense of value in exchange. That is, oh, this coffee would command a high price on the market. It's very valuable, right? Even if I don't like drinking coffee myself, I'd still call it valuable. And so sometimes price is analogized more to that second sense, in which if I was to take this coffee out of my own, inventory, or out of my own stock of goods, and put it on the market, I would get more of a price value for it than the value that I have in use. So the interesting question is how prices might end up tracking the different values in use that different people have in the economy. Different people value different things in different ways. So how is it that a market, through the mechanism of price, tends to get two people resources that they value more than other people? And how does it also get us to turn raw materials that no one values directly into some other kind of object or some other kind of good that they might use for something? So that's sort of, if you watch Benjamin's video with Michael, that's a pretty good summary of the basic economics of how price might track with value. And we can dig a little bit more into that later. But somehow, and we can explain some more of the economic theories of that, price ends up tracking with the values that people tend to have in the economy, or the marginal value, we call it. And so the person that purchases it is the person that values it the most. So price is some sort of way of communicating between people where the different subjective relative values and relative scarcities of different items are, such that the system somehow acts actually quite efficiently. Even though each individual doesn't need to actually communicate or give an announcement of what all their values are for all the different goods. Price somehow communicates between individuals what their values are for goods, and then delivers those goods to those people.
Awesome. Yeah. And what I'll mention in that regard is an important distinction, something I've been thinking about recently that may come up later as we try to understand this in terms of humans versus cells and other non-human systems, is that there's a difference between analyzing value from a first person perspective and a third person perspective. And I think where people get hung up on applying economics to non-human systems is overemphasizing the first person perspective. So we all know what value feels like, what it feels like to say, oh, I like this pen. But when we're actually analyzing value in terms of, how it affects supply and demand and people's choices, we're taking a third person perspective where we're saying, I don't know what it feels like to be this person. I don't know how they see the world. But the concept of value still allows me to ask useful questions and come up with useful predictions. And so even though we don't know what it feels like to be a cell or some other kind of non-human system, we're going to find that a third person analysis of value still allows us to apply the tools of economics to these other kinds of creatures.
Could you give me an example of that third person perspective, how that might work in a specific situation?
Yeah, so probably the most obvious example in economics is just studying firms, which are not people, they're made of people. So it's a little bit of a mixed case, perhaps. But firms, businesses, corporations, they're not people. They have their own sort of capabilities and interests that cannot be reduced to any particular person, or even any particular collection of people, without talking about the relationships between those people that are provided by the firm. But we can still say, okay, a firm wants to make money, for example. And without asking the question, what does it feel like to be Walmart, for example, we can still confidently predict Walmart is going to value making a profit. And we're going to predict, therefore, that's going to try to do things to reduce its costs and increase its revenue, which in the complexity of the world leads to all kinds of specific hypotheses about how they might behave if they anticipate this kind of thing or that kind of thing, depending on the situation.
Well, so could we take that concept of value and drive it down to the very simplest place? I've had a few conversations with Mark Solms, who's I believe, a neuroscientist who's written a book on his theory of consciousness and his theory. And I don't know that how much of it I agree with, but his theory is that consciousness arises from the function of the brainstem, that consciousness isn't all up in all the neurons and all that, but it actually is starts down at the even at the simpler level before organisms had two brain hemispheres. There was the brainstem still functioning, And that brainstem is what functions to produce homeostasis. So there's a choice has to be made between hot and cold. If hot is better for the organism at this point, it's going to move towards hot. If cold is better, it's going to move towards cold. So, you know, or moving or not moving, all everything at the brainstem level is basically a one or a zero based on what's going to produce homeostasis. And in my mind, when I think about that, that's a value. There's some sort of a value that one thing is better than the other thing. Otherwise, the organism wouldn't move. Obviously, this goes all the way back down to first life. If living isn't better than non-living, organisms wouldn't struggle to survive because there's some sort of a struggle going on there. So if we can think of value as strictly some sort of a hierarchy of something better is at the top that you're drawn towards. You're drawn towards this better thing. Otherwise, you wouldn't act. So human action is basically moving towards something that's better for you than where you're at right now. Does that make sense?
It does. The answer I want to give is maybe a little difficult to understand. It's not something I've tried to articulate before, so I might not do a very good job of doing so. So I'll just try to throw something out there and we'll see if it makes sense to people. What I think value is, that's most basic, is value is a measurement. So if I were to measure, say, the length of this pen, I could get, I don't know, maybe it's 6 inches or something. And quite literally, we could call that a value. If I ask you, what is the value of the pen's length? You could give me a numerical answer. It's 6 inches or so. The way values in this sense are sort of just data and don't have a normative property to them, although in reality, they would never exist without some kind of normative system generating them. But that's sort of a whole other question as to where measurements come from. But given this value, what happens then is some kind of system that acts as a model. Are either of you familiar with like concepts of internal models and like active inference
and
ideas like
Carl Friston,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So Marcus, just the basic idea is that you can think of organisms and systems in general as having an internal model of their environment. And by optimizing that internal model, they end up successfully navigating their environment. So when a value as a measurement sort of helps to guide an organism or some other system to some goal state, what's going on is you have some measurement and some model saying, okay, this measurement moves the model in this way. And by moving the model, it moves the organism or other system. So that's what I think of value as being at its most basic. Mm-hmm. It's a measurement that in the context of a model implies a motion of the model that we could then call the model's choice, for example. And so that
and
would
it's
also
moving
be
towards a fittedness, right?
Moving towards a goal state of some kind, which in a particular context could be usefully thought of as fit. And that would be an example of analyzing this stuff from a third person perspective. And you can see the limitations of a first person perspective. You don't perceive your own internal model. You don't perceive yourself as pursuing goal states in an abstract sense. But from a third person perspective, these are useful and valid ideas. And they let us analyze things that we can't empathize with directly because we don't know what it's like to be a cell or a business, et cetera.
I think the concept of fittedness comes in more when you start to talk about how that value translated through a model into an action starts to fit in terms of an environment. So is there something about the environment that then would correct the way that that agent or that individual item started to value something? So it says, I'm going to move towards in this direction, but if that environment doesn't kill off or prevent or constrain that agent from pursuing that goal, then they wouldn't eventually reach some sort of fittedness. So there are some orders or some ecologies that are going to tend towards fittedness just from the agents pursuing values themselves, and some in which other rules or other additional mechanisms might need to assist them to get to that eventual fitted state.
Some way in which the environment acts back on
Yeah, but
have you read Armin Alchian's paper on evolution?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, cool. So, Karen, there's a very cool paper by an economist named Armin Alchian where he talks about how firms go through something like a Darwinian process, where firms that don't do a good job of making like smart pricing decisions and so forth will just be selected out. They'll run out of money. They'll go out of business. So you have something that's sort of like an evolutionary process. It's an early example of a significant analogy between economics and biology, which is much more popular today than it was back when you wrote that paper. But it's very cool and very readable. I'll send it to you.
Oh, that'd be terrific. Yeah.
And then, but what's interesting about that is, so there's an additional paper by Becker, 1962, where Alchin's paper is primarily talking about firms and profit maximization. He says, we always say that firms are profit maximizing, but really all that matters is that they make positive profit and they don't lose money and they're not kicked out of the market, right? So they don't need to be these perfect maximizers that know everything in the world. They just need to have made the luckiest enough guess to not have been kicked out of the market. And then Becker says, a few years later, there's something very analogous with consumers, where consumers you can even think of as making random choice decisions, but you can still see a sort of rationality in the market because their choices are still disciplined by prices and budgets. But what's interesting about this is, so Becker's paper was called The Economics of Irrationality or Economics of Irrational Behavior or something like that. But Kirzner had a response article to it, and this is one of the Kirzner's earlier famous articles where he said, well, it might be true that you can get some sort of rationalizing behavior at the market level just from individuals randomly selecting their bundles with respect to a budget constraint, but you can't get them to market equilibrium. So something about moving the price in the market towards the equilibrium between buyers and sellers actually requires another level of a cognition, or just maybe to keep it simple, some other mechanism by which these agents or whoever is doing the price setting notices the difference between the price and the potential equilibrium price and actually tries to move it. So they have to actually be able to observe the shortages or observe the surpluses. So another dimension that you might introduce for analysis is what mechanisms or what methods do people have to notice shortages or surpluses in a market, such that they might become entrepreneurs and move the price closer towards the market value or the market equilibrium.
What does that, could you translate that into like the housing market?
Yeah, so if people just make random decisions about where they're going to live or something like that, or random decisions about when or when they're not going to buy a house, the price of housing is going to discipline whether or not they can actually make those purchases. So what actual things get decided on the market. But for those prices to shift either up or down towards a level at which those shortages or surpluses are collapsed, you actually have to have a real estate agents that notice, oh, there's a shortage in housing in this area, or there's a surplus of housing in this area, and they actually and then they actually have to enter in and build houses or put new things on the market and now compete other people to bring the price down. How that mechanism happens, such that the prices actually end up equaling the value or equaling the market equilibrium, is a slightly different process than simply just people making choices that are randomly disciplined against by the budget
Well,
constraint.
so in that sense, market equilibrium would be when there is no shortage or excess of housing.
Yes.
Okay. And then that requires an outside input.
Yeah,
It can't just
or
come from within the market. It can't come from within the distributed cognition itself.
it's possible for it to come from distributed cognition in that it's the agents themselves doing something or being able to notice and respond to something. So you might think of it as it's not just agents who are trying to maximize their own utility or choosing what they want to purchase or what they want to sell, but also agents noticing another kind of event, which is like a profit opportunity to move the price or to introduce new items into the market. And that also brings the market closer towards some kind of equilibrium. So it's another kind of thing that these agents might be noticing value in. So it's still distributed cognition, but it's not sheerly just responding to the existing prices in the market. It's also doing something that is going to shift those prices.
So it naturally occurs to me, what would that be on the cellular level? Is that Is there anything on the cellular level that goes beyond the just base level of distributed cognition? Have you thought about that, Benjamin?
Yes, so I think the answer has a lot to do with ion channels, and I actually read a cool paper about this the other day. I think that cells have something analogous to a set of feasible bundles. So when you're analyzing an economic agent, like a simple shopping decision, there's a set of feasible bundles they can purchase based on their budget and their prices. Like if you have, $5 and like apples are $1 and oranges are $2, you could buy 5 apples and 0 oranges, or 1 apple and 2 oranges, et cetera. And I think cells have something analogous to that, and how they basically their budget is in terms of, I guess, energy. And then there are feasible plans based on how, that they can sort of detect based on how, like, patterns in their ion channels based on signals they get from other cells. Unfortunately, and this may be a bit of a limiting factor in this conversation, I am also not a biologist, so I am working with Mike Levin. We're writing a paper, but he's handling the biology details. So my understanding of this stuff is still quite primitive. So I think the answer to your question is yes, there are things like this at the cell level. I think it has something to do with ion channels, but getting more specific than that, off the cuff is probably beyond what I can do. But yeah, the paper's
Well, so the
called.
ion channel is basically providing this information that's coming in from outside.
Yeah, let me see if I can find the quote here. What I was looking at. Numerous examples of. Yeah, somehow basically combinations of ion channels within cells help them to decide what is an energy efficient strategy, in the same way that budgets and prices help consumers determine what are efficient shopping decisions where they can spend all their money but no more. So if you've got $5, you want to spend all $5 or else it's a waste, but you don't want to spend $6 because you don't have $6. Ion channels somehow help cells do something analogous in terms of energy efficiency. But if you were to ask me how that works, I'm afraid I cannot tell you.
So the cells don't have any opportunity to go on the credit market, for example, something like that.
Well, they might actually, and that might be something that happens through these ion channels. I think questions like that are really important to be asking. And part of what I want to accomplish with my talk to Mike and the paper we're writing is to get people to ask those questions. And so for basically economists and biologists to work together, like an economist generating those questions, and then a biologist figuring out, okay, this might be how this could actually work and how we can actually test it. Far from I wouldn't regard that as like a humorous comment at all. I think that's a very serious hypothesis
Yeah.
that people should
Okay.
try to
And
figure out. I mean, you might be onto something.
this is just speculative, but here's something where you might think of that, where you have all the cells in your body. Let's say you're in the desert, you have no water, you're thirsty, and then you notice an oasis a little bit further away. Your cells naturally do not think that they have enough energy to keep moving 5 feet forward, right? But your brain can notice if I give up a lot today, right, then I'm gonna get enough water to feed myself to survive 5 more minutes and 5 more years, right? So that's maybe somehow your brain is the financial analyst or the insurance broker or whatever the relevant agent is that's noticing something that's basically making a loan, giving a loan to your future self, right? Such that you can push those cells beyond their energy capacity that they think themselves can do, but actually ending up making an investment that pays off in the future.
Well, so
I think there's a
here's
lot
where
to
I.
that actually. Oh, go ahead.
Well, you say Benjamin, and then I'll jump in.
Well, I think there's a lot to that analogy of the brain as operating as something akin to finance in a few different levels. The thing that I would most want to emphasize here is that, so I wrote actually, there's an essay on my website called Are recessions like Parkinson's disease, or is Parkinson's disease like a recession, or something like that? There are models of Parkinson's disease and also depression where there isn't anything physically wrong with you, but the issue is a lack of sort of motivational juice flowing through the system, which is analogous to a recession as sort of an insufficient supply of money that makes it hard for the economy to buy everything for sale. And there are also related models of the brain as a regulator of energy efficiency within the body. and acting as something of a market maker, where its job is to just balance out all the different flows throughout the economy. And so I think you've hit the nail on the head there. The brain as finance is a very serious hypothesis that I should think should be investigated. And also additionally, just to extend that, you could sort of think of the finance as like the cognitive glue of the cognitive glue. So the price system is the cognitive glue of the economy. In theory, finance is actually not necessary for the system to operate. You can just have a bunch of different like spot markets handling everything where people just trade directly. But what finance does is it helps to smooth over all of the frictions and difficulties as the economy becomes very large, both in space and time, you know, extends across the earth, and it can extend decades or centuries into the future. You need a specialized system just for smoothing out all of the incompatibilities that would otherwise exist as people handle their bilateral trades. I think the brain does something similar in the body, where basically a cutting edge theory of brain evolution is that the brain evolved to handle the internal body as it became increasingly complex. And what the brain's job, analogous to finance, is just to handle all those incompatibilities as the systems of the body, including the individual cells, work out their trades with each other. The brain helps manage everything and smooth out incompatibilities in a way that I do think is analogous to a well-functioning financial system.
I was going to throw in something a little radical, so you don't have to comment on it, either one of you, but I've given a lot of thought to this idea that it's a loop of sacrifice, that the cells are always sacrificing on behalf of the whole, because some of the cells have to die off so that other cells can come in, and the cells are always sacrificed in terms of exchanging materials. So there's all this exchange going on at the cellular level. There's a constant flow of sacrifice, but and they're doing that so that the whole survives. But there are times, as you said, like you need that extra bit of energy to get over there to where the water is, and the cells don't have that energy, but the brain can motivate something that happens. And so at the brain level, the sacrifice is I'm willing to entertain the pain that's going to be required of me in order to keep the whole intact. Because without that sacrifice, I would just say, you know, it's easier to sit down here. I remember a time when we lived in Iowa, and it was 80 degrees below zero, and there by the wind chill factor, and there had been this enormous snowstorm that had blocked us into town. We couldn't get out to our little farm, a quarter of a mile out of town, to feed the animals. We couldn't get a car out there, so we had to walk. And we're walking this quarter mile, and within probably halfway there, it just felt like, I can't make it. It's easier to just sit down here and die. And it took every bit of mental energy to make that last two blocks or whatever it was. Because there are sometimes when it's easier not to move, but it's better to move. So that trade-off between easier and better is where you have to have a loop of sacrifice that's from the top down to the bottom, and then brings the bottom back up, and the bottom then can continue to sacrifice for the top.
And this is similarly speculative, but it's also, you can think of maybe like a state of depression as a state in which whatever your values that you were seeking for, they're no longer as appealing, and therefore the desire to sacrifice for the present for the future is just less and less and less appealing. So depression is some sort of cycle of non-sacrifice, almost, maybe.
There's a few things going on here. I'd say the most obvious thing from an economic perspective is just that there's this sort of funny thing that happens. There's these two ideas, I guess, that are at least superficially in tension with each other. Whereas when you're trading with someone in a market with prices, you know, you do these trades because they're mutually beneficial. So we would expect every part of the system to be better off by being part of the system and engaging with their activities. But the way you make these trades is by agreeing not to take everything. When I buy a bundle of goods in the market, I'm agreeing not to buy everything else. And without making that agreement, I wouldn't be able to buy what I do buy. So in a way, you can think of what the market does is it gets everyone to say, okay, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do this. And by clarifying all of the directions you're not going to go, all of the paths you're not going to take, you open up those paths for other people to take, which allows for everyone to take mutually compatible paths, to have mutually compatible plans, which is what the price system is all about achieving, getting everyone to agree with each other, to have ultimately the same plan without ever realizing it, for how society will operate as a prediction. Everyone agrees with everyone else about what they're going to do by agreeing, I won't go here, I won't go here, I won't go here. That helps everyone get along.
I never thought about opportunity cost that way, that what you're actually doing by functioning that way is to open up opportunities for other people, as well as the cost to yourself of choosing one opportunity and not choosing others. That's really cool. Yeah, thank you for that.
Absolutely.
Now what I'm curious about is, okay, so there are certain subunits in the economy, like a family or a small household or other communities in which people support one another, that probably don't operate, that don't operate on a very obvious sense of mutually beneficial exchange, right? Like a parent sacrificing for their child, or someone sacrificing for someone that's not well off, or that's on hard times or something like that. So is it possible that there are in an economy, just like in the body, there's mutually beneficial systems and non-mutually beneficial systems that somehow both are attracting action or attracting attention, and that are both, some mix of both systems is required to keep the entire whole stable?
So this is something that my paper with Mike will talk a little bit about, which is that all of these agglomerations exist because of transaction costs. So Karen, there's a very important paper by Ronald Coase, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, called, actually, I forget, is it called The Theory of the Firm or The Nature of the Firm or something?
The Nature of the Firm.
Yeah, so it's about why do businesses exist? And this is a funny question, because businesses are such like a seemingly fundamental aspect of the economy. And what Ronald Coase pointed out is that businesses were actually incompatible with the most basic economic analysis, which just says that people trade through prices and they just contract with each other. When you go to a business, you don't do that. Your boss doesn't say, okay, I'm going to pay you $18 to do this, then I'll pay you $13 to do that. And then, you know, if you want to come back tomorrow, which you don't have to, I'll pay you $28 to do this. That's how prices and contracts work. But in business, your boss just says, okay, we employ you to do X, Y, Z. And Coase's argument is that this is because using the price system is costly, which he calls transaction costs. So if you and I were going to bargain every single day over like what I'm going to pay you and what you're going to do for me and vice versa, that would be very difficult. So what's easier is for me to say, I'm just going to pay you sort of this, you know, sort of base number, and then you'll have things you'll do that will fall into this range, and we'll just kind of work it out. And this, in principle, explains all sort of human collections in society, that if the price system were costless to use, we would not have families, we would not have businesses, we would not have governments or clubs or teams or anything. We would all just be individuals interacting with each other in purely price-based terms only. Which is a very strange thing to think about, but it would in some ways be quite efficient, assuming the price system were costless to use. But basically, the reason you see these, you know, families and other structures is because the price system is expensive to use. And this is, I think, analogous to why you see structures in the body. Why do we have organs? Why do we have muscles? Why aren't the cells just bargaining with each other on an individual basis like that? And that's, I think, because of transaction costs in the body as well. So I think there's a fascinating class of hypotheses to explore there, which again will require cooperation between economists and biologists. But yeah, I mean, basically the answer to the question of why does family, you know, why do we see people sacrificing and not benefiting and so on, and all this conflict that sometimes occurs in family structures, it's because people aren't using the price system. They aren't using a cognitive glue, or at least a cognitive glue that's much less efficient than the price system is. And that's why you see these different kinds of phenomena.
So Benjamin, would that imply that, well, would that explain why in our current time, when it seems like the price system is beginning to cost less because of the proliferation of technology, we see community breaking down and we see more individualism taking place.
I think this is correct, and I think this is a process that's been going on for centuries, which is that the price system, markets, capitalism, whatever you want to call it, has been, I mean, in a non-normative sense, degrading social structure and causing traditional communities and relationships to break down. We see a lot of negatives with this, you know, the collapse of neighborhood and community and so forth. There's a lot of positives that come with this as well, like the collapse of like hierarchical and patriarchal structures, the collapse of racism and sexism. These are also examples of human agglomerations that happen due to the lack of a price system and the expansion of markets and so forth, degrade these systems as well. So a tremendous amount of sort of freedom from bad old social structures is due to the expansion of market systems. And as market systems continue to expand, we will acquire additional freedom in this capacity.
Okay, that's super interesting. And I think, I guess I have two questions for you then. So what the species of transaction cost that I'm most interested in is incomplete contracting, right? And so just to explain that, that's basically the fact that, well, one sense that you could think the market is costly is, well, it's difficult for me to go and meet another person and figure out what price we're going to do and then write down what our contract is going to be on a piece of paper. That all has costs to it that might not be worth whatever we're contracting over. But sometimes what the difficulty is in making a transaction is that it's very difficult to actually define what it is we're going to transact over. If I want to hire you to do some renovations on my house, it's hard for me to anticipate every single thing that I might want you to do or every single accident that might happen. So it's actually too risky for me because I don't know how the legal process is going to work afterwards to actually end up writing a contract. So I'd prefer to hire a full-time employee to do something like that, right? So the qu one question for Benjamin is, in your preliminary research, what would be analogous to an incomplete contract in the body? In the sense that if these cells are, in some sense, contracting with one another, there's some sort of cognitive glue that's like a price between cells. To what degree might there be incomplete contracts between cells, or things that are two that, you know, these two cells, it would be great if they could figure out how to work together towards this one project, but it's just that project is too complicated to explain through whatever means they have of communicating.
That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer, and I hope you figure out the answer to that. My inclination listening to that is actually to sort of go in the opposite direction and wonder if there's something wrong with the concept of contract and maybe exploring biological systems and other non-human systems will help us generalize the concept of contract somewhat. And the reason for that is that, yes, when you're doing contracts, you really want to define things super hard. I actually don't really like definitions. I'm not sure that they exist. I have an essay on my website called The Definition of the Cartesian Product is Weird, which basically talks about how in mathematics, definitions are less precise than people think they are. They're less meaningful than people think they are. And so if definitions aren't even really a thing in mathematics, they're definitely not things in the real world. Mike has similarly talked about how definitions are often sort of this problematic idea that really hinder how scientists explore and engage with certain ideas. And I am basically comfortable with eliminating the concept of definition from my ontology. And so what I'm thinking is maybe when humans are contracting with each other, our understanding of contract is too primitive and it needs to generalize to some new idea that I would imagine is in fact being exhibited in nature, because nature would not form our confused concepts. So maybe as we study the body, we'll end up generalizing our understanding of what a contract is.
Well, so based on what you guys are talking about right here, it seems to me like are either one of you familiar with Stephen Wolfram's work?
I've heard of him, but I can't say I'm actually familiar with it.
Okay, well, so he's a physicist, mathematician. He's quite brilliant, and he's got an idea, which may be wrong, but it's caused him to think about a lot of different things. And one of the things he's thought about in pursuing this new theory of physics is the idea of both computational irreducibility and computational reducibility. Computational irreducibility is the idea that there are some, let's say you have a program and it's too complicated. The only way you can know what's going to happen in the future is to run the program and let it run. You just let it run through time, and then you see how it falls out over time, and that's it. That's irreducible. And then there's computational reducibility, which is a little slice that comes out of the world, which is mostly computational irreducible. There's a little slice that falls out that you can understand. So all the laws of physics are a slice of computational reducibility. You know, mathematics is a slice of computational reducibility. Those are the things that we as human observers can see and can codify and can put into some sort of a package that helps us grab a little piece of the universe and understand it. And on an even simpler level, a slice of computational reducibility could be a story. So let's say I want to look at, somebody says, what did you do yesterday? I could say, well, when the alarm clock went off, my right eye opened and then my left eye opened and then I breathed deeply and then I moved and I got out of bed, and I could tell every single thing that happened to me throughout the day, and I would still be leaving out things that, you know, the way that the light moved on the tree as I was walking down the street, or the shadows that were on this, you know. It's a computationally irreducible problem to really talk about what happened yesterday. But I can make a story. I can remember the through line of what made sense to me during the day. And that little story is my computationally reducible slice. So contracts, to cover every, as you talked about in your paper on all the variables of what you have to do in a fight or flight situation, which is why fight and flight isn't a good model for what's happening when we're faced with a predator, because there's so many variables that are computationally irreducible. And contracts are that way, computationally irreducible to cover every single thing that's needed, which is why principles are better than rules. I'm going to stop.
Yeah, you've raised a very good point, actually. And I will be rewatching this video and thinking about this more. In fact, let me see what time it is. So I know the time. Okay, it's about 12:43.
Do you have a hard stop at 12, by the way?
No, I'm unemployed. I'm good okay. to go. I don't know about Marcus.
I've got something that I want to add about this, because this is actually exactly what you're talking about, Karen, is a paper that I'm working on right now that we're calling, that's about, it's, I'm working on it with a colleague, Curtis Hingle, who's still at George Mason. And it's on when institutions, which is maybe a more generalized way to talk about all sorts of contracts. So any sort of rule sets which people are commonly observing and coordinating themselves around, right? So a contract is a set of rules. You do this, I do this, and we coordinate around that as long as it's incentive compatible. But similarly, laws or the rules of the road or constitutions are like larger contracts of which we observe these rules, and then I go, oh, well, this is what actions I have to perform to be obeying or assenting to this institution or not. But the world is so much more complex than any contract or constitution or set of rules or set of legislation is going to be able to allow us to coordinate in. So when we will reach these moments, which we call in the paper awkward moments, so we kind of come up with a definition of what social awkwardness is when you find yourself in a situation in which your social institutions or social norms or rules or contracts don't define what the proper behavior is in this situation, you can still intuit a sense or figure out a sense in which other people will think this is proper, this is improper, or this is moving closer or further away from our social or larger goal. But it's much easier to do that when you have some sort of story that you're inside, in which you can intuit what the next step is, even if the rules, the reducible slices of the irreducible grand narrative that we're in, aren't able to serve us. So from day to day, in particular, stylized, regular situations, rules, things like that, are able to help us coordinate or know where we are in the local story of I drive on the right side of the road, you drive on the right side of the road. That simple story, we know our place, right? But if we end up in the middle of a traffic accident, we really need to figure out, like, where am I, who am I? And you have to tell yourself almost like a little story or narrative about where you fit in the world. So what you said about principles versus rules is similar to a lot of people that discuss what's called legal incompleteness think about, in which there might be certain situations in which we go, is this thing constitutional or not? And so when the Supreme Court meditates on that, they have to refer to meta principles, things that are not textually in the Constitution, but ideas that are assumed by the Constitution or principles that are assumed by the Constitution in order to make those decisions. And so in that sense, when we're all operating under a legal system, we're all telling ourselves a story. So the story behind the legal system is just as important as the text of the rules itself. And this is something lawyers have known for a long time, and economists are just starting to learn. And I think everyone is just starting to learn.
I would strongly recommend to both of you to read the work of Lisa Feldman Barrett. She's a neuroscientist and psychologist at Northeastern University. I'll send you both some of her work. She's got a bunch. She was my introduction to the discovery of economic structure in systems that economists don't usually study. And it was reading her work that prepared me to understand Mike's work. And she's an expert on emotion, and she sort of like revolutionized our understanding of emotion, and her work generalizes to the mind and psychological phenomena in general. And sort of her big idea is that basically your brain has to figure out what's going on in the world by dealing with a tremendous amount of incredibly complex information. And the way it does so is by basically sorting events that happen into categories and then using those categories. And she'll explicitly say it's like storytelling. Your brain basically has to tell a story about what's going on and try to compare things to previous instances to predict the next instance based on some functional similarity rather than these sort of fixed neural categories, as was often historically thought. So I think there's a tremendous amount of conceptual overlap between the kind of work that she's doing and the kind of things that you're talking about. And I suspect if we're going to try to, you know, push these generalizations, that the kind of conceptualization that the brain does is in fact analogous to these conceptualizations that form in society between people, as people being sort of, you know, superficially comparable to the neurons. It won't be perfectly analogous because the systems are physically quite different, of course. But I would strongly urge you both to check out her work. And relatedly, I have an essay on my website called Two Examples of Memory and Math that talks about how what the meaning of an element is definitely changes depending on how you understand it within a system, and gives some simple mathematical examples, which I think is a related idea as well. So definitely check out Lisa Feldman Barrett's work, because it is super relevant to what you just described. And I'll send you both some stuff.
Yeah, the way that you described her ideas is very reminiscent of Hayek in the sensory order as well. So and so Hayek, even in this early, he wrote that book 1952. So even in this early period before his more advanced political discussions, he was already thinking of the price system as something analogous to a mind. And the early people that were discussing what he was calling spontaneous order, him and Michael Polanyi were calling spontaneous order, the best analogy that they had is a system that was not designed by a mind that looks like it was designed by a mind. That was kind of their first guess way of saying what a spontaneous order is. And they have maybe some more I prefer his descriptions in Law, Legislation, and Liberty. But some sort of mechanism of taking that complex situation, simplifying it to categories, which are either used internally for a mind or externally between minds or between individuals, is a really deep idea. And it's also worth noting that Hayek's parents, or at least his father, was a biologist, and he originally thought about studying biology before he moved into law and economics.
Yes, I think that's exactly it. I read Lisa's work before The Sensory Order, and it was reading Lisa's work, although she came after, that made that book comprehensible to me. And I do think it's correct to say that Hayek anticipated many, specifically her developments, which are revolutionizing the field. She's one of the most cited researchers in the world. And a lot of what she says you can find in The Sensory Order as well.
Well, so Marcus, when you first contacted me, you saw me mention Ben's video in a discussion that I had with Rick Walker and Ira Katz. Mm-hmm. And you messaged me and you mentioned that you thought that Hayek was more in line with with those ideas than von Mises himself. So why were you saying that?
That's interesting. Hayek and Mises were both involved in this debate that was focused on the question of the viability of socialist central planning. So to make it analogous to what we've been discussing, if the entire economic problem is something that's irreducibly complex, You can think of the socialist central planner as trying to treat that irreducible problem as if it's something reducible, as if you could just figure out where the resources are in the economy and what the goals and preferences of the people are in the economy, and then just make that plan, like as if you're solving a calculus problem, right? And so the way that Mises originally approached that question is by saying, well, people need prices and they need profit and loss to know what the relative scarcities of different things are in order to make their decisions. You know, no one's actually figured out this problem. So a generation of socialists responded to him and said, oh, well, you know, we can figure that out. They proposed various mechanisms of how they would gather that information. And so Hayek's real response was to say, what the price system does is it organizes information that no one else is able to organize because the situation is irreducibly complex. So Hayek was kind of moving the debate a degree beyond what Mises had originally done. Some people read Mises as having those ideas implicitly, but I don't think that they can be directly derived out of Mises, because Mises was much more focused on sometimes what you'd call a Kantian model of the mind, where the mind does have fixed categories, and it's just what he was interested in is the socialist calculation is impossible because they don't have the data in front of them and nobody can make those price calculations. So the socialists said, okay, well, we'll just figure that out by putting the data in front of people. And Hayek said, no, the problem is so complex, you can't even get that data without the price system to sort of pull it out of people, or for the price system to be the mechanism by which they communicate that inarticulate information, which is summarizing a lot of things that the people don't even know they're summarizing, right? So Hayek pushed that debate a degree further. I think a good person to go to for a history of that debate is Don Lavoie's book, Rivalry and Central Planning. He sort of summarizes the history of that whole debate and how Hayek took it a step further than Mises did, even though Hayek saw, you know, got a lot of his original inspiration from Mises. So sometimes what Mises' version of the argument is called the calculation problem. Oh, well, the socialists aren't able to calculate where things should go in the economy. But Hayek's is called the knowledge problem, which is where you can't actually generate the relevant knowledge that you would need to solve that kind of problem. It's not something that can be solved by a single mind or a group of minds working in concert. It's actually a problem that needs this alternative mechanism of taking information from different parts of the system and putting it where it needs to be. You need the system.
So when Polanyi was talking about the I just had the phrase and I lost it. He has this beautiful phrase about all the little things that are going on in your environment that have to come together in order for the idea to exist. I just lost it. In Polanyi's whole theory of knowledge, when he's talking about
passive knowledge,
contact with reality.
Mm-hmm.
And in that whole idea of contact with reality, there are these, the only phrase that comes to me is intimations of the unknown, but that's not the phrase he was using. He's talking about all the little, kind of the thing you were talking about, Ben, about all the little variables that are existing in your surroundings all have to come together in order for knowledge to exist. And I think it's very similar concept to John Verveke's relevance realization. You're familiar with Verveke, Ben?
I've seen you, and I think he and Mike were on your talk, so I saw
yes,
that.
And I think he's been working with Mike since, because this whole idea of relevance realization, I think that also probably drives down to the cellular level. But before I throw a wrench in the works here, I want to go back, Marcus, to what you were saying about that idea of let's make that plan. You know, we're going to drive in there with coercion or whatever in order to make that plan. I think this is the brilliance of what Mike is doing, because he recognized, he took this, the new knowledge that they came to, that DNA is not capable of enforcing order on the organism, because there's not enough information in the DNA for the cells to know where to go to build the arm, or how long the arms are going to be as they're building. That information is not in the DNA. So that has to come somewhere else from this distributed cognition that's happening in the bioelectrical signaling. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, if you watch the video on my channel on cosmos and taxis, you can think of a biological system as definitely a cosmos in which the DNA is the rule. So all of the cells are following the rule blindly, and they develop this order that is not initially in the DNA. So if you broke down the DNA, you wouldn't see a blueprint of a human body or something like that. You'd see a bunch of chemical things that are analogs to rules that different other chemicals are going to obey, and they're going to form cells that then interact with one another in a certain way that develops the entire body. But what's interesting about it is that there is no actual blueprint in which you can define ex ante before you actually reach those situations, all of the ways in which that system should respond to all of the situations it's going to deal with in the future. So you can think, oh, if we planned the entire future of a body, or planned, like, game theoretically, what its strategies are going to be in every single situation in the future, you wouldn't actually be able to create a body that survives through all those situations. You have to create it at an abstract level so that it can handle new information that can't be known ex ante or can't be known beforehand.
Yeah, and on the topic of DNA, again, yeah, neither of us are biologists, so we're both just kind of guessing as to what the best analogy is. But what I've been thinking is that DNA, it's less about rules in any sense and more about capital. Like it's just about like supplying proteins to the cells, and like different cells get different proteins, and just by those differences in the available resources and where the cell is in the system, they end up developing different, like, the specialization and division of labor, and the cells start exhibiting new competencies. Just like a human being, you take like a raw human, you put them in one situation, they become a lawyer, another situation, they become like a coal miner or something, and you get these very big differences from very similar starting points with just like a little bit of a tip one way or another. I think that might be what DNA is doing to generate all the complexity and division in the human body. It's just you get these proteins, you get these proteins, and you get these very big divisions over time. And again, it's all just these economic analogies. And ideally, we'll figure out, testable hypotheses, confirm them either in an organism or in a computational model. And I think there's just like a lot of, I'm not part of academia, but I think there's just a lot of like low-hanging fruit in terms of papers and citations. So I hope a lot of economists pick this stuff up, and I'm really glad that you are.
Yeah, well, now I'm not sure I agree with that analogy, because you're saying something like the differences in DNA is analogous to the different situation that person is in, such that they become a lawyer or a coal miner. But I think that what DNA also is it's the initial, or it allows for the initial ordering system that allows you to go, oh, what is the best thing that I could evolve into in this situation? It's a lawyer. Or what is the best thing I could evolve into in this situation? It's a coal miner. And those different situations is more analogous to the environment that the entity ends up in.
Yes, I think you put that more precisely. I think it's broadly analogous to like just what resources are available to me. Do I have coal? Do I have oil? Do I have lumber? And yeah, through that, the cell has like a whole internal economy. I think Mike would basically agree with that, that inside of a cell is a city, just like a, is a city, are we near a river? We have a bunch of mountains, and that's going to determine a very different character of a city over time. You see a similar thing happening with cells.
Well, so here I want to throw a little question into you guys. I know that Austrian economics is based on the subjective theory of value. So could you both define how you see subjective theory of value and objective theory of value? And then maybe we could play a little bit with this, because in today's world, in the postmodern world, the idea of everything being subjective has become kind of a toxic idea that is about to destroy the universe. So how do we differentiate out the beautiful subjective theory of value that's the basis of Austrian economics from the subjective theory of value that's destroying the world?
Well, I'll just tell you up front that I do, in fact, think that all values are subjective and there's no such thing as objective value. I think that's just an empirical scientific fact. Now, regarding the way people use this theory, I think you're correct that people often take this idea and they run in very bad directions with that. And there are two very important observations I would make in that regard, which is, first of all, most people who take this idea in strange directions don't really know what they're talking about and do not actually understand why everything is subjective. They're not really familiar with the science and the relevant ideas there. And second, they're just wrong about the connotations. Like, imagine that someone says, okay, the earth is round. That's a scientific fact. And since we live on the earth, and they start to make this argument, well, we live on the earth, it's like sort of defines what everything should be. So therefore, we should be round. We should all try to be as obese as possible to mimic Mother Earth. And then you have like this huge obesity crisis that's killing everyone. They're correct that the earth is round, but they're taking this in a really weird direction that I think most physicists would disagree with. So that's how I see this question. I do think everything is subjective and that this is just the best way of describing the evidence, but the direction people take this is often highly confused.
Yeah, I actually think that something is going to change in the next 50 years or so, because Austrians or Austrian like table thumpers have been saying subjective value for 150 years, mostly because when in the 1870s, when this event called the Marginal Revolution was happening and a lot of criticisms were being made of classical political economy, focus on a subjective theory of value as opposed to objective theories that had to do something with labor power, you know, invested in items. Was a better way of explaining how price dynamics worked. But I think that we're getting to a point in which we really have to start understanding how people's valuations relate to the environment around them. So that is how their values that they generate from their internal economies, let's say, have to do with the external economies. And I'm just very early getting to a sense of what this might mean. And me and Nate Heil kind of got into this a little bit because we started reading the Philosophy of Economy by Bulgakov, who was a theologian. And so he knows the differences between he was an economist before a theologian and a priest. So he was tracking the debate between subjective theories of value and objective theories or labor theories of value. And he starts to see where he goes, I see where they're coming from and why one is a correction for the other, but the best theory has to somehow heal the subjective-objective divide. And we have to somehow get over that in order to have a fully integrated system of why is a human in an economy acting the way they do. And so he starts translating all into theology such that a modern economist can't use much out of it. But I'm interested in seeing how that theology might inform economics. But I'm at the very early stages of thinking about that.
Well, I'm just going to think my way through this for a second. So let's say you used the example earlier about water, that if you're coming out of the desert, or maybe it was Ira, that I was listening to Ira this morning. If you've just come out of a desert, that glass of water is going to have a much higher value to you than it does if you're sitting on a boat dock or something with a beer in your hand. And that's true of every level of organism, from the cells all the way up, there's a sense of what is good, and each part of the distributed order is moving towards what is good because that's the value that is bringing about the action. But the good is not the same for every one of the organisms. Some of those organisms probably need to be in a warmer environment. Some of them need to be in a colder environment. So their sense of what is good is going to be different, unique to them. And that's true for every part. Mm-hmm. But the part that seems to me that has to be objectively real, if I could use that word, is the good itself. There has to be something towards which everything is moving.
I think it's related to what is called the classical philosophical. I never thought about it this way, but it's related to what the classical philosophical problem of the one and the many. Are things fundamentally one, or are they fundamentally many?
Yes, it totally, yes.
So the capacity to which things can be many, you can have a notion of subjectivity. And then if I can say the difference between these two organisms, I can see differences in the way they value things or the way they respond to the same situations. That's what we'd call their different valuations. And I go, oh, well, they're many. So all value is subjective and things are just operating in some system until they maybe create meta-level patterns. But fundamentally, all the value is something in all of the parts. Or I can see the things towards which the entire system tends. And I say, oh, well, that's what the entire system values. So you can basically make a choice at some point. Am I going to analyze at the system level or at the part level? And somehow we need a way of understanding this that you're understanding it at the system and the part level simultaneously. And that's
Yes,
something that's
it
very,
would be
very
what
difficult to do.
Verbakia is always talking about. The emanation and the emergence have to be
Yes.
functioning together. Like with the human body, you have all the cells. They're all doing their own thing. They have their own perspective on things, but they all have to be working together towards the whole. And then the whole is protecting all the parts so that you have the one and you have the many simultaneously.
Yeah, and so it's been kind of another hobby horse in Austrian economics for a long time to talk about methodological individualism, right? Oh, all analysis should be at the individual level, and then all of their plans interact. But even some of the more recent Austrian economists, I'm thinking like Richard Wagner, not the famous composer, but a guy named Richard Wagner, who's an econ professor, has a book called Macroeconomics as Systems Theory, I think. And one thing he talks about is, well, yeah, let's say the monetary equilibrium or the degree of the price level based on the money supply and people's interactions is going to be some emergent property from the purchase choices of all of the agents in the economy. But then what they do ends up creating some system level property that then re-informs the agents down below. So there has to be some sense in which economists don't just do methodological individualism. That is, think about agents from their own subjective internal system, but think of agents as fundamentally embedded in a larger system, and then understand how those two the two systems, the larger and the microcosmic system, might interact with one another, or how
Well,
that they're part of an
this is
equilibrium
partly
system.
what Mike is always talking about, and I mean a lot of the other developmental biologists too, and this idea of niche construction, that the organism is building their niche as they go, because that's they're finding their world that's working for them. But then the niche itself acts as an environmental training program for the organism. So the organism is acting on the environment, the environment's acting back on the organism, and there's this ratcheting going on all the time. I mean, I have my own ideas, but that's a great picture as far as it goes, but I think it's incomplete. I think there has to be that other agent acting on this thing in order to make the whole thing function, but I'll
And
leave that out of.
where Bulgakov goes with it is to say, oh, well, what you guys are talking about is the mystery of the Trinity anyway. They've always been wrestling with this, saying, oh, how can the good, the greatest thing, be one and three at once, or one and many at once, and include its creation in it? And so somehow, whatever that mystery or love, that thing that makes that seemingly logically impossible thing possible, is what will solve your problem, but you don't get to answer how it works. It's a mystery, la la la. So
Well, I
it's
mean that
interesting how
whole
these
business of
terms are
love
being.
Pirsig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, when he talks about the dynamics of quality, that dynamics of quality that's always drawing everything upwards. I think that's where that love piece comes in. It's always drawing everything upwards. And Richard Watson, who's one of the guys that works with Mike Levin on a lot of things, when I threw that at him once, he said, well, of course it's love that draws, but I don't know what he's thinking of when he thinks of love. So.
I'll mention that I
Jump in,
think there's
Dan.
just
I saw that look on your face, like you had something to say.
I do. I mean, I do think, as much as humans try to find a sort of nice description of things, there's a brutal undercurrent to economics, which is just the reality of scarcity, which is you can't have everything all at once. If you have two organisms or two systems with sufficiently incompatible goal states, at least one of those systems has to change or die. We see this all over in ways big and small. And insofar as we see a system tending towards anything, there's a big selection effect there, where what we're not seeing is all of the things tending against that simply fail to exist. In the same way that it's hard to come up with a sense of physics that doesn't just say, well, the heat death of the universe is just going to be the end of all things, I don't think there's ever going to be a sense of economics that describes how everything can find some kind of unity without sort of leaving out all the things that aren't part of that unity and therefore have been wiped out or were never able to come into being in the first place. I'll also mention on the subject of love, love is an emotion. Lisa Feldman Barrett is the world's leading expert on emotion. So reading about her stuff, which again I'll send you, may give you some interesting ideas about love as well.
Well, I tend to think of love as an action rather than an emotion, but I am interested in read. I've seen a lot of videos from her, and I've tapped into them for a few moments, but I haven't had the time to pursue it as much as I would want to. But on this idea of scarcity, is there another side of scarcity? I'm thinking here. It's a complicated idea, but in terms of opportunity cost, when I walk through Costco, there's total abundance everywhere, right? But because of my own personal scarcity, I can't buy everything. So I'm limited in what I can buy. I'm limited in what I can buy based on how much money I have, but also on how big my car is. And then once I get it home, how big my house is and how much room there is for all these things. So there's many different levels of that are entrained on that are preventing me from buying everything I might want at Costco. So how does that picture work in that this whole idea of scarcity in economics in general?
Well, with regard to that specific situation, economists would just lump all of that under constrained optimization. So the limited storage space in your car might just impose a maybe sort of soft limit on your budget, and would probably still try to analyze things in monetary terms and just try to say, okay, theoretically, she might have thousands of dollars in her bank account, but realistically, maybe she could only fit like $500 worth of stuff in her car. Beyond that, I am very interested in generalizations of scarcity. I have another talk with Mike's lab about mathematical agency, where I argue that scarcity might be the same thing as logical consistency, where both scarcity and logical consistency have the same effects on economics and math, respectively, which is to say, you can't have everything all at once. No matter what you try to do, there's always going to be a trade-off where gaining one thing means giving something else up. So when I think about scarcity, I'm often thinking about logical consistency and the kinds of limitations that imposes on what you're able to do and the trade-offs that it requires.
So in that sense, scarcity almost functions as what you might call like reality. You bump up against reality, right? Reality kind of snaps back on you if you try to overstep. Could you tie that into scarcity? Is that too far afield?
Well,
Reality, go ahead.
yeah, I was just going to say that this is again related to the conversation we had about Bulgakov, because he compares scarcity, I don't remember if he uses that term exactly, but to the condition of death, the fact that at some point this ordered system which you're trying to keep going is going to fall apart, right? So what labor is the continual response against the reality of death. And and there was one other thing that he said. Oh, and also I think he's really taking that from Maximus the Confessor. Ultimately, this is something that Chris Green mentioned when we were at the conference in Washington, that Maximus the Confessor, when his idea was that choice was a product of the fall. So a human without sin would not have a notion of choice. They would just have their will towards the good. Choice is a condition, is a byproduct of the fact that you are in a fallen state, or that your soul is in a fallen state, and therefore that you have to choose between one or the other things because of death. So death and choice are in a sense the same reality.
Well, let's bring it back to the material level and think about entropy. One of the physicists I've talked with quite a bit has this idea that entropy is a kind of forgetfulness in the sense that there's no longer enough information available to put the system back together the way that it was. And that's what entropy looks like. So I think of entropy as connected to price in the sense that, let me see, I wrote this down so that I could get it right without having to pause too much. And of course, I won't be able to find it. Well, why don't you guys talk about that entropy there for just a second? Let me see if I can find this thing where I wrote this down.
I mean, I can think of entropy as the system becoming less consistent over time, which is strange if you think of scarcity as consistency and entropy as the lack of consistency, but maybe what you're fighting against when you make choices, or you're fighting against the loss of control over things. I don't know. What do you think about that, Ben?
Well, entropy won't affect the logical consistency of the universe. And that's the only sense in which scarcity and consistency are the same thing. It's just logical consistency. I don't understand entropy. I mean, obviously, it's very important. But I think it's weird that it's not a natural outcome of economics per se. Like if you were just doing economics, I don't know that you would ever come up with entropy, or if you did, I don't know that you'd think of it as something particularly important or plausible. So I would want to understand, and I'm not a physicist, but like, is entropy an inevitable result of like any sort of mathematically consistent universe, or are there many universes that don't have entropy? And if it's the latter, I would honestly basically say entropy is like a weird thing in our universe and it's not economics. But I would need a physicist to tell me what's going on with that.
Well, so I've had like 15 hours of discussion on entropy on the channel. So, and I don't know what it is. And honestly, the physicist that I've been talking to, the more questions I ask, he said the bigger the hole gets, because entropy is very complicated, very difficult to understand. And it crosses many arenas. So you have information entropy, you have thermodynamic entropy, we have all these different kinds of entropy. But if we just think of entropy in terms of, you could think of it in terms of increasing disorder or increasing spread outness or an increasing incapacity to have the information that you need to go back into order. Life reverses the whole entropy process. So life is neg entropy, basically. Which means if there's a price to pay in order to live, if there's a price to be paid in order to survive, which I think there is, because movement is harder than non-movement. And, you know, striving towards a goal is harder than not striving towards a goal. So there's some kind of a price there, whether it's a sacrifice or an economic price, I don't know, but there's some sort of a price. And that's overcoming entropy, because entropy wants to pull you back down into this disordered state. So you have to overcome the entropy in order to survive. Then this production also has the invariable effect of increasing entropy. So whenever you've produced order, there's going to be an increase in disorder in the universe. So because the disorder never decreases. So every time you produce order, you've introduced more entropy into the system.
But you've reorganized it in some way.
What?
But you've reorganized it in some way.
Well,
when you produce a new object.
When you reorganize something in the world into an organized system, you have increased the amount of disorder in the rest of the system. So you could think of it this way. Let's say you have a messy room, which you would look at it and you could say, wow, there's a lot of disorder in that room, a lot of entropy. So you go in and you use physical energy to organize that room, but you're also using mental energy to organize the room. But as you're organizing the room, it's also reorganizing what's in your mind. Mm-hmm. So you're using a lot of energy in your mind, which potentially increasing the disorder in other parts of your mind, because you're ordering one part while another part maybe is being overwhelmed by that use of all this information here. So it's always all getting moved around, but there's always a slight increase in the entropy in the total system. And that's where the mystery comes in, I think.
Yeah, what's mysterious to me, I guess, is that it's just not obvious to me from an economic perspective why that's true. If it's true in economics, like I understand what you're saying is correct, but I don't sense how it comes from economics, and so maybe it doesn't. But I'm quite used to thinking of things as coming from economics. So it's true that when you do something, you always pay a price, but that price is your opportunity cost. There's nothing in economics that I'm aware of that says that the rest of the system should become disordered. It just says you did one thing and did not do another thing. But that's the economic cost. So the fact that also the physical system becomes less ordered and less orderable, yeah, I don't know how to analyze that. I just don't know why that has to be a thing.
I think because opportunity cost is an entirely subjectively defined phenomenon. So it would have to be somewhere between subjective and objective understandings of an economic system. But that is understandings that primarily focus on agents making choices and the system in which they're making choices or the world in which they're making choices.
Well, so what happens if I make a choice and that the choice that I'm making means I'm not making all these other choices. Now all those other choices are open for other players to come in to those other choices. But what if you're in a system where some of those choices don't get used by other players? I've opened those choices, as Ben was talking about, but now no new. Maybe some new players are only coming into some of those choices, and other ones have been created by my choice, by my limitation has created a lot of other openings, but only some of those openings have been snatched by certain entrepreneurs, and the rest of them are just sitting there. Would that be an evidence of some kind of entropy? And maybe entropy is just opportunity. Maybe the increase in disorder in the system is just opportunity, because Peterson's always talking about order and chaos, and that you're at your most productive when you're at the edge between order and chaos, because that's where all the dynamism survives on that edge. As you reach over or fall over accidentally into chaos, there's a lot of opportunity there. And if you can see the treasure being held by the dragon and bring it back into the order, then you've revivified the order. But that means that all that chaos out there is some sort of maybe a picture of what entropy looks like, which is where all the opportunities are.
I've thought about that only notionally, just from the fact that in economics, we always say that choices are made on the margin. And then when I was first listening to Peterson's stuff, he was talking about the margin between order and chaos, and that's where you make choices. But the notion of marginal utility or marginal choice in economics is much more of a mathematical concept. And I mean, that's just a synchronicity between those words. Perhaps it's a mere coincidence, but I have thought about what might be the common pattern there.
I would probably want to point out that I think things go in the opposite direction in terms of the relationship between opportunity and entropy. The presence of unclaimed opportunities may be attributable to entropy in the sense that to claim those opportunities, you need a system that can organize that subsystem where the opportunity is present to then exploit the opportunity. If we don't see that happening, that presumably reflects the costs of organizing, which may be one way of characterizing entropy. So you could imagine theoretically a world where organization is very easy and happens to sort of, I guess, the maximum degree anywhere it's logically possible to. And in that sense, you'll see all of the opportunities opened up by your actions instantly exploited to the maximum extent possible by every other element of the system. In our universe, we don't see that because it's just very hard to do.
Do we not see that because of too much government intervention? I mean, do you think that it would be possible to have, do you think in a more perfect world, it would be possible to actually have free market economics where that could be functioning without too much government intervention?
It certainly won't be the case that an absence of government intervention is sufficient to make sure that all such opportunities are fully exploited, if only because, again, you have the reality that entropy just is what it is, and the system just can't do that. As a practical matter, a lot more opportunities would be exploited in an absence of government intervention, like the opportunity to make a lot of money by building more housing. as the high price of housing is sending a signal asking suppliers to do, that's not being exploited because of regulations making that difficult. So you'd certainly see a lot more exploiting of opportunities, but still not to the maximum extent conceivable, again, because of entropy.
And that's a very Kirchnerian point, because you could say, in a sense, that the reality of entropy, the fact that part of the world is entropic, is why everyone does not have the same exact interpretation of the state of the world and all profit opportunities are exploited, right? So the fact that there is a part of the world which is maybe not entirely chaotic, but is ordered in ways that don't fit with the normal ways we think order works, means that someone might be able to stand at the edge of order, look out into the entropy, and see the treasure and the dragon that no one else had seen before. So it's why all treasures of all dragons have not been exploited at the initial time period, right? It's why profit opportunities are only revealed over time, because the way that our minds interact with the potential of entropy changes and varies over time, dependent on the particularities of the individual. And that's what Kirchner focuses on, is that's what the price system rewards, someone looking out into the places that other people maybe have looked before, but with a new interpretation of it, such that they're aware of profit opportunities no one else was.
And that's the definition of an entrepreneur.
Yeah, or well, that's the way that he defines it. That's debated. People push back on him on that one. But the way that he defines an entrepreneur is someone who has the quality that makes them aware of certain profit opportunities that other people are not aware of. So they are the individual part of a system that by their actions adds information to the prices that are then reflected through the rest of the system. So without an entrepreneur, the price system doesn't have any information to relay.
Nothing to say on that, Benjamin?
No, I do, but just nothing specific. It's yeah, I can see why people would push back on that, like the specific claims about, like, adding information to the price system. It's like, what exactly do we mean by that? It's definitely something that needs to be made much more. And I assume people have worked on this. I'm not familiar specifically, but yeah, definitely something that needs something like to just add to the clarity and rigor of that statement. I can definitely see what it's getting at. Because yeah, you need people to actually do the thing. Like, you have a formal description of a system, and then the way that the system actually behaves to sort of mimic that formal system, which makes that formal system a useful description of it. And that behavior may involve elements. And like Mike has a paper about how sorting algorithms have agential properties that don't match their formal description. And yeah, the price system might similarly need these agents to push things into place that then allows you to say, okay, that makes your formal description of it actually useful. Yeah, there are powerful ideas there, but yeah, I don't feel like I have any specific insights.
Well, we're coming up on an hour and a half. Do either of you have any final word about price and how it might relate to just anything, any systems?
I will certainly say, and this is something that my paper with Mike will mention, although not fully elaborate on, but provide the basic groundwork for, which is that as far as I can tell, any coherent entity or system that's worth treating as sort of an individual entity, like a human being, a cell, a firm, whenever that really is an extremely good model, what's going on is that the internal elements of that system, such as the workers or the cells or whatever, are connected by a cognitive glue that is always analogous to the price system, up to the limit of being a system of complete markets, which means everything is just governed by markets, prices, contracts, and nothing else. All coherent systems are going to fit that description. That's the hypothesis.
I guess the last thing that I'd add is that I think where economics is going next, and maybe this makes me sound un-Austrian to say this, is that people are realizing that there is some bottom limit, or maybe upper limit, to how many things prices can coordinate, such that other things, rules, ideologies, other sorts of systems, other sorts of interpersonal systems are another communication mechanism that's necessary to get the price system off the ground, but also to be able to communicate or coordinate on things that the price system cannot, or that simple contracts cannot, or information that prices can't relay. So there's always going to be if the price system helps us organize the ordered knowledge, there's always going to be some liminal edge or margin at which either entrepreneurs or firms or other systems of organizing knowledge are going to be useful.
That's cool.
And the thing that occurred to me just now, and so maybe I'm going to take your two more minutes of your time, is if we went back in time, somebody mentioned that if we went back in time, there would be a time before markets were necessary. Do you think that's possible? I mean, when there were actually human beings with cognitive processes in social arenas, do you think it's possible to go back to a time before markets and prices were necessary?
I mean, if you look way back, or if you look at Hayek's later work, that's essentially what he's talking about. He's talking about how social systems evolved in primitive bands and how we are people whose biology evolved so that we survive in a small band of 40 people that maybe have some sort of primitive notion of property rights and simple trading, but most of our production and consumption is done in common. And so we're not creatures that are evolved exactly to live in market environments with prices. So someone that doesn't recognize or doesn't attribute the wealth that they live on to the market system or to the price system might think that we can treat the entire world as one big band. And this is sort of his atavistic theory of socialism, he calls it, or atavistic theory of collectivism, where someone thinks we can run an economy like the band because all of their human intuitions say that you can run the nation like you run a family.
There's a sort of known theorem that basically says any system that does what the price system does as well as the price system does it must be the price system mathematically. So when human beings are coordinating, which is what the price system does, they must either be using something that is exactly analogous to the price system, or they must be interacting with each other much less efficiently than they would be if the price system governed everything, which might just be what's happening with small bands. As far as going back to that, I don't think that would be possible unless a bunch of humans died, which maybe will happen. But as long as our nation, our world is as big as it is and as complex as it is, we will definitely need something very efficient, which means something very similar to markets and prices.
Well, from what you were saying, Ben, it seems to me logical that even in these early bands or whatever they were, that something analogous to the price system has to be functioning. I mean, you have to organize your labor somehow in a group so that the people that are better at hoeing are hoeing, and the people that are better at sowing are sowing, and the people who are better at hunting are hunting. And so there's still some sort of negotiation going on, which I'm assuming that price has to do with negotiation. So So I'm looking forward to your paper when it comes out. I hope you tag me on that, and any information that you guys want to send us that we can put in as resources for people who are listening, I think that would be great. And I will send you some information about somebody to contact about a job, Benjamin. This is very exciting.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I'll definitely send some things your way, and you, Marcus, as well. This was a very interesting conversation. I got a lot out of it, and just thank you so much, Karen, for organizing this. This was fantastic.
I hope we can do it again.
I'm very happy to have been a part of it.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.